was after I became confused, more like an adrenaline response to being scared. I remember feeling great, actually, just before it had happened. Did anything else unusual happen that day? No, I'd just come home from Los Angeles. Are you having any hot flashes? No. Well, I felt what could have been one while I was disoriented, but again, I think I was just scared. Okay, how are you sleeping? Fine. How many hours are you getting each night? 5 to 6. Is this a change from what it had been in the past? No. Any difficulty falling asleep? No. How many times do you typically wake up during the night? I don't think I do. Do you go to bed at the same time every night? Usually, except when I travel, which has been a lot lately. Where have you traveled? In the last few months, California, Italy, New Orleans, Florida, New Jersey. Were you sick after any of these trips, any fevers? No. Are you taking any medications, anything for allergies, supplements, anything that you might not normally think of as a medicine? Just a multivitamin. Any heartburn? No. Any weight changes? No. Any bleeding in your urine or bowel movements? No. She asked each question rapidly on the heels of each answer, and the topics jumped from one to the next before Alice had time to follow the reasoning behind them. As if she were riding a roller coaster with her eyes shut, she couldn't predict which way she was being turned next. Are you feeling more anxious or stressed than typical? Just about not being able to remember things, otherwise no. How are things with your husband? Fine. Do you think your mood is pretty good? Yes. Do you think you could be depressed? No. Alice knew depression. Following the deaths of her mother and sister when she was 18, she'd lost her appetite, she'd been unable to sleep for more than a couple of hours at a time, despite being endlessly tired, and she'd lost an interest in enjoying anything. It had lasted a little over a year, and she'd never experienced anything like it since. This was entirely different. This wasn't a job for Prozac. Do you drink alcohol? Just socially. How much? 1 or 2 glasses of wine with dinner, maybe a little more on a special occasion. Any drug use? No. Dr. Moyer looked at her, thinking. She tapped her pen on her notes as she read them. Alice suspected the answer wasn't anywhere on that piece of paper. So am I in menopause? She asked as she gripped her parchment-papered seat with both hands. Yes. We can run an FSH, but everything you tell me is completely consistent with menopause. The average age of onset is 48 to 52, so you're right in there. You may continue to get a couple of periods a year for a while. That's perfectly normal. Can estrogen replacement help with the memory problems? We don't put women on estrogen replacement anymore, unless they're having sleep disturbances, really awful hot flashes, or they're already osteoporotic. I don't think your memory problems are due to menopause. The blood rushed from Alice's head. Precisely the words she dreaded and only recently dared to consider. With that one professionally uttered opinion, her tidy and safe explanation shattered. Something was wrong with her, and she wasn't sure that she was ready to hear what it was. She fought the impulses growing louder inside her, begging her to either lie down or get the hell out of that examining room immediately. Why not? The symptoms of memory disturbances and disorientation listed for menopause are secondary to poor sleep hygiene. Those women aren't coping well cognitively because they aren't sleeping. It's possible that you're not sleeping as well as you think you are. Perhaps your schedule and jet lag are taking a toll. Perhaps you're worrying about things throughout the night. Alice thought about the times she'd suffered from fuzzy thinking caused by bouts of sleep deprivation. She certainly hadn't played at the top of her mental game during the last weeks of each pregnancy, following the birth of each child, and at times when she was up against a grant deadline. In none of those circumstances, however, did she get lost in Harvard Square. Maybe. Could I suddenly need more sleep because I'm older or because I'm in menopause? No, I don't usually see that. If it's not lack of sleep, what are you thinking? She asked, the clarity and confidence now completely absent from her voice. Well, I'm concerned about the disorientation in particular. I don't think it was a vascular event. I think we should do some tests. I'm going to send you for blood work, a mammogram, and a bone density because it's time, and a brain MRI. A brain tumor. She hadn't even considered that. A new predator loomed in her imagination, and she felt the ingredients of panic once again brewing in her gut. If you don't think it was a stroke, what are you looking for in the MRI? It's always good to definitively rule these things out. Make the appointment for the MRI, and then want to see me right after, and we'll go over everything. Dr. Moyer had avoided answering the question directly, but Alice didn't push her to reveal her suspicions. And Alice didn't share her tumor theory. They would both just have to wait and see. William James Hall housed the departments of psychology, sociology, and social anthropology, and was located just beyond the gates of Harvard Yard on Kirkland Street, a region referred to by students as Siberia. Geography, however, was not the most prominent factor that alienated it from the main campus. William James Hall could never be mistaken for any of the stately, classically collegiate structures that adorned the prestigious yard and housed the freshman dormitories and classes in mathematics, history, and English. It could, however, be mistaken for a parking garage. It possessed no Doric or Corinthian columns, no red brick, no Tiffany stained glass, no spires, no grand atrium, no physical detail whatsoever that might obviously or subtly affiliate it with its parent institution. It was a 210-foot, unimaginative beige block, quite possibly the inspiration for B.F. Skinner's box. Not surprisingly, it had never been featured in the student walking tour or the Harvard calendar, spring, summer, winter, or fall. Although the view of William James Hall was inarguably abysmal, the view from it, in particular from many of the offices and conference rooms on the upper floors, was nothing short of splendid. As Alice drank her tea at her desk in her office on the 10th floor, she relaxed in the beauty of the Charles River and Boston's Back Bay, framed before her by the enormous southeast-facing window. It captured a scene that many artists and photographers have reproduced in oil, watercolor, and film, and that could be found matted and framed on the walls of office buildings all over the Boston area. Alice appreciated the glorious advantages available to those fortunate enough to regularly observe the live version of this landscape. With the changes in the time of day or year, the quality and movement within the picture in her window altered in tirelessly interesting ways. On this sunny morning in November, Alice's view of Boston from WJH Fall displayed the sunlight sparkling like champagne fizz off the pale blue glass of the John Hancock building, and several skulls steadily sliding along a smooth and silvery Charles toward the Museum of Science, as if being pulled by a string in a motion experiment. The view also provided her with a healthy awareness of life outside Harvard. A glimpse of the red and white neon Citgo sign flashing against a darkening sky over Fenway Park fired her nervous system like the sudden ring of an alarm clock, awakening her from the daily trance of her ambitions and obligations and triggering thoughts of heading home. Years ago, before she was tenured, her office had been in a small, windowless room within the interior of William James Hall. Lacking visual access to the world beyond its solid beige walls, Alice had regularly worked late into the night without even realizing it. On more than one occasion, she'd been stunned at the end of the day to discover that a nor'easter had buried Cambridge in more than a foot of snow, and that the less focused and/or window-owning faculty had all wisely abandoned William James Hall in search of bread, milk, toilet paper, and home. But now she needed to stop staring out the window. She was leaving later that afternoon for the annual Psychonomic Society meeting in Chicago, and she had a ton to accomplish before then. She looked over her to-do list. Review Nature Neuroscience paper? Check. Department meeting? Check. Meet with TAs? Check. Cognition class? Finalize conference poster and itinerary? Run? Airport. She drank the last watery sip of her iced tea and began to study her lecture notes. Today's lecture focused on semantics, the meaning of language, the third of six classes on linguistics, her favorite series of classes for this course. Even after 25 years of teaching, Alice still set aside an hour before class to prepare. Of course, at this point in her career, she could meticulously deliver 75% of any given lecture without consciously thinking about it. The other 25%, however, contained insights, innovative techniques, or points for discussion from current findings in the field, and she used the time immediately before class to refine the organization and presentation of this newer material. The inclusion of this constantly evolving information kept her passionate about her core subjects and mentally present in each class. Emphasis for the faculty at Harvard tipped heavily toward research performance, and so a lot of less than optimal teaching was tolerated by both the students and the administration. The emphasis Alice placed on teaching was in part motivated by the belief that she had both a duty and the opportunity to inspire the next generation in the field. Or at the very least, not to be the reason the next would-be great thought leader in cognition abandoned psychology to major in political science instead. Plus, she simply loved teaching. Ready for class, she checked her email. Alice, we're still waiting on you for three slides to be included in Michael's talk. One word retrieval graph, one model of language cartoon, and one text slide. His talk isn't until Thursday at 1 o'clock, but it would be a good idea for him to drop your slides into the presentation as soon as possible. Make sure he's comfortable with it all, and that it still falls within the allotted time. You can email them to either me or Michael. We're staying at the Hyatt. See you in Chicago. Kind regards, Eric Greenberg. A cold and dusty light bulb flickered on inside Alice's head. That was what the mysterious Eric had meant on one of her to-do lists last month. It didn't refer to Eric Wellman at all. It was meant to remind her to email those slides to Eric Greenberg, a former colleague at Harvard, now a professor in the psychology department at Princeton. Alice and Dan had put together three slides describing a quick and dirty experiment Dan had run as part of a collaboration with Eric's postdoc, Michael, to be included in Michael's talk at the psychonomic meeting. Before doing anything else that might distract her, Alice emailed the slides, along with sincerest apologies, to Eric. Fortunately, he'd get them in plenty of time. No harm done. As with most everything at Harvard, the lecture auditorium used for Alice's cognition course was grander than necessary. The blue upholstered chairs arranged in stadium seating numbered several hundred more than the students enrolled in the class. An impressive, state-of-the-art audiovisual center stood at the back of the room, and a projection screen as big as those in any movie cinema hung at the front. While three men busily hooked up various cables to Alice's computer and checked the lighting and sound, students wandered in, and Alice opened her linguistics classes folder on her laptop. It contained six files: acquisition, syntax, semantics, comprehension, modeling, and pathologies. Alice read the titles again. She couldn't remember which lecture she was supposed to give today. She'd just spent the last hour looking over one of these subjects, but couldn't remember which one. Was it syntax? They all looked familiar to her, but none more salient than the others. Ever since her visit with Dr. Moyer, each time Alice forgot something, her foreboding intensified. This wasn't like forgetting where she left her BlackBerry charger or where John left his glasses. This wasn't normal. She'd begun telling herself in a tortured and paranoid voice that she probably had a brain tumor. She also told herself not to freak out or worry John until she heard the more informed voice of Dr. Moyer, which unfortunately wouldn't be until next week, after the psychonomic conference. Determined to get through the next hour, she took a deep, frustrated breath. Although she didn't remember the topic of today's lecture, she did remember who her audience was. "Can someone please tell me what it says on your syllabus for today?" Alice asked the class. Several students called out in a staggered, collective voice, "Semantics!" She had gambled correctly that at least a few of her students would pounce on the opportunity to be visibly helpful and knowledgeable. She didn't worry for a second that any of them would think it grievous or strange that she didn't know the subject of today's class. There existed a great metaphysical distance in age, knowledge, and power between undergraduate students and professors. Plus, over the course of the semester, they'd witnessed specific demonstrations of her competence in class and had been wowed by her dominant presence in the course literature. If any of them gave it any consideration whatsoever, they probably assumed that she was so distracted with other obligations more important than Psychology 256 that she didn't have time even to glance at the syllabus before class. Little did they know that she'd just spent the last hour concentrating almost exclusively on semantics. The sunny day had turned cloudy and raw by evening, the first real flirtation with winter. A hard rain the night before had knocked most of the remaining leaves off their branches, leaving the trees nearly naked, underdressed for the coming weather. Comfortably warm in her fleece, Alice took her time walking home, enjoying the cold autumn air smell and the crunchy swishing sound her feet made as they strolled through the piles of grounded leaves. The lights were on inside her house, and John's bag and shoes rested next to the table by the door. "Hello? I'm home," said Alice. John walked out from the study and stared at her, looking confused and at a loss for words. Alice stared back and waited, nervously sensing that something was dreadfully wrong. Her mind raced straight to her children. She stood frozen in the doorway, braced for horrible news. "Aren't you supposed to be in Chicago?" "Well, Alice, all of your blood work came back normal, and your MRI is clean," said Dr. Moyer. "We can do one of two things. We can wait, see how things go, see how you're sleeping and how you're doing in 3 months, or I want to see a neurologist." December 2003. On the night of Eric Wellman's holiday party, the sky felt low and thick, like it was going to snow. Alice hoped it would. Like most New Englanders, she'd never outgrown a childlike anticipation of the season's first snow. Of course, also like most New Englanders, what she wished for in December, she'd come to loathe by February, cursing her shovel and boots, desperate to replace the frigid, monochromatic tedium of winter with the milder pinks and yellow greens of spring. But for tonight, snow would be lovely. Each year, Eric and his wife Marjorie hosted a holiday party at their home for the entire psychology department. Nothing extraordinary ever happened at this event, but there were always small moments that Alice wouldn't dream of missing. Eric sitting comfortably on the floor in a living room full of students and junior faculty on couches and chairs. Kevin and Glenn wrestling for ownership of a Yankee-swapped Grinch doll. The race to get a slice of Marty's legendary cheesecake. Her colleagues were all brilliant and odd, quick to help and argue, ambitious and humble. They were family. Maybe she felt this way because she didn't have living siblings or parents. Maybe the time of year made her sentimental, searching for meaning and belonging. Maybe that was part of it, but it was also much more. They were more than colleagues. Triumphs of discovery, promotion, and publication were celebrated, but so were weddings and births and the accomplishments of their children and grandchildren. They traveled together to conferences all over the world, and many meetings were piggybacked with family vacations. And like in any family, it wasn't always good times and yummy cheesecake. They supported one another through slumps of negative data and grant rejection, through waves of crippling self-doubt, through illness and divorce. But most of all, they shared a passionate quest to understand the mind, to know the mechanisms driving human behavior and language, emotion and appetite. While the holy grail of this quest carried individual power and prestige, at its core it was a collaborative effort to know something valuable and give it to the world. It was socialism powered by capitalism. It was a strange, competitive, cerebral, and privileged life, and they were in it together. The cheesecake gone, Alice snatched the last hot fudge-drenched cream puff and looked for John. She found him in the living room in conversation with Eric and Marjorie, just as Dan arrived. Dan introduced them to his new wife, Beth, and they offered hearty congratulations and exchanged handshakes. Marjorie took their coats. Dan had on a suit and tie, and Beth wore a floor-length red dress. Late and much too formal for this party, they'd probably gone to another one first. Eric offered to get them drinks. "I'll have another one, too," said Alice, the glass of wine in her hand still half full. John asked Beth how she liked married life so far. Although they'd never met, Alice knew a little about her from Dan. She and Dan had been living together in Atlanta when Dan was accepted at Harvard. She'd stayed in Atlanta, originally content with a long-distance relationship and the promise of marriage after he graduated. 3 years later, Dan had carelessly mentioned that it could take easily 5 to 6, maybe even 7 years, for him to finish. They had married last month. Alice excused herself to use the ladies' room. On the way, she lingered in the long hallway that connected the newer front of the house to the older back, finishing her wine and cream puff as she admired the happy faces of Eric's grandchildren pictured on the walls. After she found and used the bathroom, she wandered into the kitchen, poured herself another glass of wine, and fell captive to a boisterous conversation among several of the faculty wives. The wives touched elbows and shoulders as they moved about the kitchen. They knew the characters in each other's stories. They praised and teased each other. They laughed easily. These women all shopped and lunched and attended book clubs together. These women were close. Alice was close with their husbands, and it set her apart. She mostly listened and drank her wine, nodding and smiling as she followed along, her interest not truly engaged, like running on a treadmill instead of on an actual road. She filled her wine glass again, slipped unnoticed out of the kitchen, and found John in the living room in conversation with Eric, Dan, and a young woman in a red dress. Alice stood next to Eric's grand piano and strummed the top of it with her fingers while she listened to them talk. Each year, Alice hoped that someone would offer to play it, but no one ever did. She and Anne had taken lessons for several years as children, but now she could only remember Baby Elephant Walk and Turkey in the Straw without sheet music, and only the right hand. Maybe this woman in the fancy red dress knew how to play. At a pause in the conversation, Alice and the woman in red made eye contact. "I'm sorry, I'm Alice Howland. I don't believe we've met." The woman looked nervously at Dan before she answered. "I'm Beth." She seemed young enough to be a graduate student, but by December, Alice would have at least recognized even a first-year student. She remembered Marty mentioning that he'd hired a new postdoctoral fellow, a woman. "Are you Marty's new postdoc?" asked Alice. The woman checked with Dan again. "I'm Dan's wife." "Oh, so nice to finally meet you. Congratulations." No one spoke. Eric's gaze bounced from John's eyes to Alice's wine glass and back to John, carrying a silent secret. Alice wasn't in on it. "What?" asked Alice. "You know what? It's getting late, and I've got to get up early. You mind if we get going?" asked John. Once they were outside, she meant to ask John what that awkward saccade was about, but she became distracted by the gentle beauty of the cotton candy snow that had begun to fall while they were inside, and she forgot. 3 days before Christmas, Alice sat in the waiting room of the Memory Disorders Unit at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, pretending to read Health magazine. Instead, she observed the others who waited. They were all in pairs. A woman who looked 20 years older than Alice sat next to a woman who looked at least 20 years older than her, most likely her mother. A woman with big, unnaturally black hair and big gold jewelry talked loudly and slowly in a thick Boston accent to her father, who sat in a wheelchair and never looked up from his perfectly white shoes. A bony, silver-haired woman flipped pages of a magazine too quickly to be reading anything next to an overweight man with matching hair and a resting tremor in his right hand. Probably husband and wife. The wait to hear her name took forever and seemed longer. Dr. Davis had a young, hairless face. He wore black-rimmed glasses and a white lab coat, unbuttoned. He looked like he used to be thin, but his lower torso slumped a bit beyond the outline of his open coat, reminding Alice of Tom's comments about the poor health habits of physicians. He sat in a chair behind his desk and invited her to have a seat across from him. "So, Alice, tell me what's been going on." "I've been having lots of problems remembering, and it doesn't feel normal. I'm forgetting words in lectures and conversation. I need to put cognition class on my to-do list, or I might forget to go teach it. I completely forgot to go to the airport for a conference in Chicago and missed my flight. I also didn't know where I was for a couple of minutes once in Harvard Square, and I'm a professor at Harvard. I'm there every day." "How long have these things been going on?"
"Since September, maybe this summer."
"Alice, did anyone come here with you?"
"No."
"Okay. In the future, you're going to have to bring a family member or someone who sees you regularly in with you. You're complaining about a problem with your memory. You may not be the most reliable source of what's been going on." She felt embarrassed, like a child, and his words, "in the future," harassed her every thought, commanding obsessive attention, like water dripping from a faucet.
"Okay," she said.
"Are you taking any kind of medicine?"
"No, just a multivitamin."
"Any sleeping pills, diet pills, drugs of any kind?"
"No."
"How much do you drink?"
"Not a lot. One or two glasses of wine with dinner."
"Are you a vegan?"
"No."
"Have you had any sort of past injury to your head?"
"No."
"Have you had any surgeries?"
"No."
"How are you sleeping?"
"Perfectly fine."
"Have you ever been depressed?"
"Not since I was a teenager."
"How's your stress level?"
"The usual. I thrive under stress."
"Tell me about your parents. How's their health?"
"My mother and sister died in a car accident when I was 18. My father died of liver failure last year."
"Hepatitis?"
"Cirrhosis. He was an alcoholic."
"How old was he?"
71.
"Did he have any other problems with his health?"
"Not that I know of. I didn't really see much of him over the last several years."
"And when she did, he was incoherent, drunk."
"What about other family?"
She relayed her limited knowledge of her extended family's medical history.
"Okay, I'm going to tell you a name and address, and you're going to repeat it back to me. Then we're going to do some other things, and I'm going to ask you to repeat the same name and address again later. Ready? Here it is. John Black, 42 West Street, Brighton. Can you repeat that for me?"
She did.
"How old are you?"
50.
"What is today's date?"
December 22nd, 2003.
"What season is it?"
"Winter."
"Where are we right now?"
8th floor, MGH.
"Can you name some of the streets near here?"
"Cambridge, Fruit, Starrow Drive."
"Okay, what time of day is it?"
"Late morning."
"Name the months backward from December."
She did.
"Count backward from 100 by 6.
He stopped her at 76.
"Name these objects."
He showed her a series of 6 cards with pencil drawings on them.
"Hammock, feather, key, chair, cactus, glove."
"Okay, before pointing to the window, touch your right cheek with your left hand."
She did.
"Can you write a sentence about today's weather on this piece of paper?"
She wrote, "It is a sunny but cold winter morning."
"Now draw a clock and show the time as 20 minutes to 4.
She did.
"And copy this design." He showed her a picture of 2 intersecting pentagons. She copied them.
"Okay, Alice, hop up on the table. We're going to do a neurological exam."
She followed his penlight with her eyes. She tapped her thumbs and pointer fingers together rapidly. She walked heel to toe in a straight line across the room. She did everything easily and quickly.
"Okay, what was that name and address I told you earlier?"
"John Black."
She stopped and searched Dr. Davis's face. She couldn't remember the address.
What did that mean? Maybe she just hadn't paid close enough attention.
It's Brighton, but I can't remember the street address.
Okay, is it 24, 28, 42, or 48?
She didn't know.
Take a guess.
48?
Was it North Street, South Street, East Street, or West Street?
South Street?
His face and body language didn't expose whether she'd guessed right, but if she had to guess again, that wasn't it.
Okay, Alice, we have your recent blood work and MRI. I want you to go for some additional blood work and a lumbar puncture. You're going to come back in 4 to 5 weeks, and you'll have an appointment for neuropsychological testing on that same day before you see me.
What do you think is going on? Is this just normal forgetting?
I don't think it is, Alice, but we need to investigate it further.
She looked him directly in the eye. A colleague of hers had once told her that eye contact with another person for more than 6 seconds without looking away or blinking revealed a desire for either sex or murder. She reflexively hadn't believed this, but it had intrigued her enough to test it out on various friends and strangers. To her surprise, with the exception of John, one of them always looked away before the 6 seconds was up. Dr. Davis looked down at his desk after 4 seconds. Arguably, this meant only that he wanted neither to kill her nor tear her clothes off, but she worried that it meant more. She would get prodded and assayed, scanned and tested, but she guessed that he didn't need to investigate anything further. She told him her story, and she couldn't remember John Black's address. He already knew exactly what was wrong with her.
Alice spent the earliest part of Christmas Eve morning on the couch, sipping tea and browsing through photo albums. Over the years, she had transferred any newly developed pictures to the next available slots beneath the clear plastic sleeves. Her diligence had preserved their chronology, but she'd labeled nothing. It didn't matter. She still knew it all cold. Lydia, age 2, Tom, age 6, and Anna, 7, at Harding's Beach in June of their first summer at the Cape House. Anna at a youth soccer game on Pocosset Field, she and John on 7 Mile Beach on Grand Cayman Island. Not only could she place the ages and setting in each snapshot, but she could also elaborate in great detail on most of them. Each print prompted other unphotographed memories from that day, of who else had been there, and of the larger context of her life at the time that the image was captured. Lydia in her itchy powder blue costume at her first dance recital. That was pre-tenure. Anna was in junior high school and in braces. Tom was lovesick over a girl on his baseball team, and John lived in Bethesda on sabbatical for the year. The only ones she had any real trouble with were the baby pictures of Anna and Lydia, their flawless, pudgy faces often indistinguishable. She could usually find clues, however, that revealed their identities. John's mutton chop sideburns placed him solidly in the 1970s. The baby in his lap had to be Anna.
"John, who's this?" she asked, holding up a picture of a baby. He looked up from the journal he'd been reading, slid his glasses down his nose, and squinted.
"Is that Tom?"
"Honey, she's in a pink onesie. It's Lydia."
She checked the Kodak printed date on the back to be sure. May 29th, 1982. Lydia.
"Oh," he said.
He pushed his glasses back up onto the bridge of his nose and resumed reading. "John, I've been meaning to talk to you about Lydia's acting classes." He looked up, dog-eared the page, set the journal on the table, folded his glasses, and settled back in the chair. He knew this wouldn't be quick.
"All right.
I don't think we should be supporting her out there in any way, and I certainly don't think you should be paying for her classes behind my back."
"I'm sorry, you're right. I meant to tell you, but then I got busy and forgot. You know how it gets. But I disagree with you on this. You know I do. We supported the other two."
"That's different."
"It's not. You just don't like what she picked."
"It's not the acting. It's the not going to college. The window of time she's likely to ever go is rapidly closing, John, and you're making it easier for her to stay out."
"She doesn't want to go to college."
"I think she's just rebelling against who we are."
"I don't think it has anything to do with what we want or don't want or who we are."
I want more for her. She's working hard, she's excited and serious about what she's doing, she's happy. That's what we want for her. It's our job to pass on our wisdom about life to our kids. I'm really afraid she's missing out on something essential. The exposure to different subjects, different ways of thinking, the challenges, opportunities, the people you meet. We met in college. She's getting all that. It's not the same. So, it's different. I think paying for her classes is more than fair. I'm sorry I didn't tell you, but you're hard to talk to about this. You don't ever budge. Neither do you. He glanced at the clock on the fireplace mantel, reached for his glasses, and placed them on top of his head. I've got to go to lab for about an hour, then I'll pick her up at the airport. You need anything while I'm out? He asked as he stood to leave. No. They locked eyes. She's going to be fine, Allie. Don't worry. She raised her eyebrows but didn't say anything. What else could she say? They'd played the scene out together before, and this was how it ended. John argued the logical path of least resistance, always maintaining his status as the favorite parent, never convincing Alice to switch over to the popular side. And nothing she said swayed him. John left the house. Relaxed in his absence, she returned to the pictures in her lap. Her adorable children as babies, toddlers, teenagers. Where did the time go? She held the baby picture of Lydia that John had guessed was Tom. She felt a renewed and reassuring confidence in the strength of her memory. But of course, these pictures only opened the doors to histories housed in long-term memories. John Black's address would have lived in recent memory. Attention, rehearsal, elaboration, or emotional significance was needed if perceived information was to be pushed beyond the recent memory space into longer-term storage. Else it would be quickly and naturally discarded with the passage of time. Focusing on Dr. Davis's questions and instructions had divided her attention and prevented her from rehearsing or elaborating on the address. And although his name elicited a bit of fear and anger now, the fictitious John Black had meant nothing to her in Dr. Davis's examining room. Under these circumstances, the average brain would be quite susceptible to forgetting. Then again, she didn't have an average brain. She heard the mail drop through the slot in the front door and had an idea. She looked at each item once. A baby wearing a Santa hat pictured on a holiday greeting card from a former graduate student, an advertisement for a fitness club, the phone bill, the gas bill, yet another L.L. Bean catalog. She returned to the couch, drank her tea, stacked the photo albums back on the shelf, and then sat very still. The ticking clock and brief eruptions of steam from various radiators made the only sounds in the house. She stared at the clock. 5 minutes passed. Long enough. Without looking at the mail, she said aloud, "Baby and Santa hat card, gym membership offering, phone bill, gas bill, another L.L. Bean catalog." Piece of cake. But to be fair, the time between being presented with John Black's address and being asked to recall it had been much longer than 5 minutes. She needed an extended delay interval. She grabbed the dictionary off the shelf and devised two rules for picking a word. It had to be low frequency, one she didn't use every day, and it had to be a word that she already knew. She was testing her recent memory, not learning acquisition. She opened the dictionary to an arbitrary page and put her finger down on the word berserk. She wrote it on a piece of paper, folded it, put it in her pants pocket, and set the timer on the microwave for 15 minutes. One of Lydia's favorite books when she was a toddler was Hippos Go Berserk. Alice went about the business of readying for Christmas Eve dinner. The timer beeped. Berserk, without hesitation or needing to consult the piece of paper. She continued playing this game throughout the day, increasing the number of words to remember to 3 and the delay period to 45 minutes. Despite this added degree of difficulty and the added likelihood of interference from the distraction of dinner preparation, she remained error-free. Stethoscope, millennium, hedgehog. She made the ricotta, raviolis, and red sauce. Cathode, pomegranate, trellis. She tossed the salad and marinated the vegetables. Snapdragon, documentary, vanish. She put the roast in the oven and set the dining room table. Anna, Charlie, Tom, and John sat in the living room. Alice could hear Anna and John arguing. She couldn't make out the topic from the kitchen, but she could tell it was an argument by the emphasis and the volume of the back and forth. Probably politics. Charlie and Tom were staying out of it. Lydia stirred the hot mulled cider on the stove and talked about her acting classes. Between concentrating on making dinner, the words she needed to remember, and Lydia, Alice didn't have the mental reserve to protest or disapprove. Uninterrupted, Lydia spoke in a free and passionate monologue about her craft, and despite Alice's strong bias against it, she found she couldn't resist being interested. "After the imagery, you layer on the Elijah question, why this night rather than any other?" said Lydia. The timer beeped. Lydia stepped aside without being asked, and Alice peeked in the oven. She waited for an explanation from the undercooked roast, long enough for her face to become uncomfortably hot. Oh, it was time to recall the three words in her pocket. Tambourine, serpent. "You're never playing everyday life as usual. The stakes are always life and death," said Lydia. "Mom, where's the wine opener?" Anna hollered from the living room. Alice struggled to ignore her daughter's voices, the ones her mind had been trained to hear above all other sounds on the planet, and to concentrate on her own inner voice, the one repeating the same two words like a mantra. Tambourine serpent, tambourine serpent, tambourine serpent. "Mom," asked Anna. "I don't know where it is, Anna. I'm busy. Look for it yourself." Tambourine serpent, tambourine serpent, tambourine serpent. "It's always about survival when you boil it down. What does my character need to survive, and what will happen to me if I don't get it?" said Lydia. "Lydia, please, I don't want to hear about this right now," Alice snapped, holding her sweaty temples. "Fine," said Lydia. She turned herself squarely toward the stove and stirred vigorously, obviously hurt. "Tambourine serpent." "I still can't find it," yelled Anna. "I'll go help her," said Lydia. "Compass. Tambourine serpent compass." Relieved, Alice took out the ingredients for the white chocolate bread pudding and placed them on the counter. Vanilla extract, a pint of heavy cream, milk, sugar, white chocolate, a loaf of challah bread, and 2 half-dozen cartons of eggs. A dozen eggs? If the piece of notebook paper with her mother's recipe on it still existed, Alice didn't know where it was. She hadn't needed to refer to it in years. It was a simple recipe, arguably better than Marty's cheesecake, and she'd made it every Christmas Eve since she was a young girl. How many eggs? It had to be more than 6, or she would have taken out only 1 carton. Was it 7, 8, 9? She tried skipping over the eggs for a moment, but the other ingredients looked just as foreign. Was she supposed to use all of the cream, or measure out only some of it? How much sugar? Was she supposed to combine everything all at once, or in a particular sequence? What pan did she use? At what temperature did she bake it, and for how long? No possibility rang true. The information just wasn't there. What the hell is wrong with me? She revisited the eggs. Still nothing. She hated those fucking eggs. She held one in her hand and threw it as hard as she could into the sink. One by one, she destroyed them all. It was marginally satisfying, but not enough. She needed to break something else, something that required more muscle, something that would exhaust her. She scanned the kitchen. Her eyes were furious and wild when they met Lydia's in the doorway. "Mom, what are you doing?" The massacre had not been confined to the sink. Empty shards of shell and yolk were splattered all over the wall and counter, and the faces of the cabinets were streaked with tears of albumin. "The eggs were past the expiration date. There's no pudding this year." "Aw, we have to have the pudding. It's Christmas Eve." "Well, there aren't any more eggs, and I'm tired of being in this hot kitchen." "I'll go to the store, go into the living room and relax. I'll make the pudding." Alice walked into the living room, shaking but no longer riding that powerful wave of anger, not sure whether she was feeling deprived or thankful. John, Tom, Anna, and Charlie were all seated and in conversation, holding glasses of red wine. Apparently, someone had found the opener. With her coat and hat on, Lydia poked her head into the room. "Mom, how many eggs do I need?" January 2004. She had good reasons to cancel her appointments on the morning of January 19th with the neuropsychologist and Dr. Davis. Harvard's exam week for the fall semester fell in January, after the students returned from winter break, and the final exam for Alice's cognition class was scheduled for that morning. Her attendance wasn't crucial, but she liked the sense of closure that being there provided, of seeing her students through the course from start to finish. With some reluctance, she arranged for a teaching fellow to proctor the exam. The bigger good reason was that her mother and sister had died on January 19th, 32 years ago. She didn't consider herself superstitious like John, but she'd never received good news on that day. She'd asked the receptionist for another date, but it was either then or 4 weeks from then. So she took it, and she didn't cancel. The idea of waiting another month was that unappealing. She imagined her students back at Harvard, nervous about what questions they would be asked, hurrying a semester's worth of knowledge onto the pages of their blue exam books, hoping their heavily crammed short-term memories wouldn't fail them. She understood exactly how they felt. Most of the neuropsychological tests administered to her that morning, Stroop, Raven's colored progressive matrices, Luria mental rotation, Boston naming, Wace R picture arrangement, Benton visual retention, NYU story recall, were familiar to her. They were designed to tease out any subtle weakness in the integrity of language fluency, recent memory, and reasoning processes. She had, in fact, taken many of them before, serving as a negative control in the cognition studies of various graduate students. But today she wasn't a control. She was the subject being tested. The copying, recalling, arranging, and naming took almost 2 hours to complete. Like the students she imagined, she felt relieved to be done and fairly confident in her performance. Escorted by the neuropsychologist, Alice entered Dr. Davis's office and sat in one of the two chairs arranged side by side, facing him. He acknowledged the empty chair next to her with a disappointed sigh. Even before he spoke, she knew she was in trouble. "Alice, didn't we talk about you coming here with someone last time?" "We did." "Okay, it's a requirement of this unit that every patient comes in with someone who knows them. I won't be able to treat you properly unless I have an accurate picture of what's going on, and I can't be sure I have that information without this person present. Next time, Alice, no excuses. Do you agree to this?" "Yes." "Next time." Any solid relief and confidence generated from her self-evaluated competence in the neuropsychological exams evaporated. "I have the results of all of your tests now, so we can go over everything. I don't see anything abnormal in your MRI. No cerebral vascular disease, no evidence of any small, silent strokes, no hydrocephalus or masses. Everything there looks fine. And your blood work and lumbar puncture all came back negative as well. I was as aggressive here as we can be and looked for every condition that could sensibly account for the kinds of symptoms you're experiencing. So we know you don't have HIV, cancer, a vitamin deficiency, mitochondrial disease, or a number of other rare conditions." His speech was well constructed, obviously not his first delivery of its kind. The what she did have would come at the end. She nodded, letting him know that she followed him and that he should continue. "You scored in the 99th percentile in your ability to attend, and things like abstract reasoning, spatial skills, and language fluency. But unfortunately, here's what I do see. You have a recent memory impairment that is out of proportion to your age and is a significant decline in your previous level of functioning. I know this from your own account of the problems you've been having and from your description of the degree to which they've been interfering with your professional life. I also personally witnessed it when you couldn't retrieve the address I asked you to remember the last time you were here. And although you were perfect in most of the cognitive domains today, you showed a lot of variability in two of the tasks that were related to recent memory. In fact, you were down to the 60th percentile in one. When I put all of this information together, Alice, what it tells me is that you fit the criteria of having probable Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease. The words knocked the wind out of her. What exactly did he just tell her? She repeated his words in her head. Probable. It gave her the will to inhale, the ability to speak. So probable means that I might not fit the criteria. No, we use the word probable because the only definitive diagnosis for Alzheimer's right now is by examining the histology of the brain tissue, which requires either an autopsy or a biopsy, neither of which is a good option for you. It's a clinical diagnosis. There's no dementia protein in your blood that can tell us you have it, and we wouldn't expect to see any brain atrophy on an MRI until much later stages in the disease. Brain atrophy. But this can't be possible. I'm only 50. You have early onset Alzheimer's. You're right. We typically think of Alzheimer's as a disease that affects the elderly, but 10% of people with Alzheimer's have this early onset form and are under the age of 65. How is that different from the older form? It's not, except that its cause usually has a strong genetic linkage, and it manifests much earlier. Strong genetic linkage. Anna, Tom, Lydia. But if you only know for sure what I don't have, how can you say with any certainty that this is Alzheimer's? After listening to you describe what's been happening into your medical history, after testing your orientation, registration, attention, language, and recall, I was 95% sure. With no other explanation turning up in your neurological exam, blood, cerebral spinal fluid, or MRI, the other 5% goes away. I'm sure, Alice. Alice. The sound of her name penetrated her every cell and seemed to scatter her molecules beyond the boundaries of her own skin. She watched herself from the far corner of the room. "So what does this mean?" she heard herself ask. "We have a couple of drugs for treating Alzheimer's now that I want to put you on. The first is Aricept. It boosts cholinergic functioning. The second is Namenda. It was just approved this fall and has shown a lot of promise. Neither of these is a cure, but they can slow the progression of symptoms, and we want to buy you as much time as possible." Time. How much time? "I also want you to take vitamin E twice a day and vitamin C, baby aspirin, and a statin once a day. You don't show any clear risk factors for cardiovascular disease, but anything that's good for the heart is going to be good for the brain, and we want to preserve every neuron and synapse we can." He wrote this information down on a prescription pad. "Alice, does anyone in your family know that you're here?" "No," she heard herself say. "Okay, you're going to have to tell someone. We can slow the rate of cognitive decline that you've been experiencing, but we can't stop it or reverse it. It's important to your safety that someone who sees you regularly knows what's going on. Will you tell your husband?" She saw herself nod. "Okay, good. Then fill these prescriptions, take everything as directed, call me if you have any problems with side effects, and make an appointment to come back in 6 months. Between now and then, you can call me or email me if you have any questions, and I would also encourage you to contact Denise Daddario. She's the social worker here and can help you with resources and support. I'll see you and your husband together then in 6 months, and we'll look at how you're doing." She searched his intelligent eyes for something else. She waited. She became strangely aware of her hands clenching the cold metal arms of the chair she sat in. Her hands. She hadn't become an ethereal collection of molecules hovering in the corner of the room. She, Alice Howland, was sitting on a cold, hard chair next to an empty chair in a neurologist's office in the memory disorders unit on the 8th floor of Massachusetts General Hospital. And she'd just been diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. She searched her doctor's eyes for something else, but could find only truth and regret. January 19th. Nothing good ever happened on that day. In her office with the door shut, she read through the activities of daily living questionnaire that Dr. Davis had told her to give to John. "This should be filled out by an informant, not the patient," was typed in bold at the top of the first page. The word informant, the closed door, and her pounding heart all contributed to a feeling of conspicuous guilt, like she was hiding in some Eastern European city, in possession of illegal documents, and the police were on their way, sirens blaring. The rating scale for each activity ranged from 0, no problems, same as always, to 3, severely impaired, totally dependent on others. She scanned down the descriptions next to the 3s and assumed they represented the end stages of this disease, the end of this straight and short road that she'd been suddenly forced onto in a car with no brakes and no steering. Number 3 was a humiliating list. Must be fed most foods. Has no control over bowel or bladder. Must be given medication by others. Resists efforts of caretaker to clean or groom. No longer works. Home or hospital bound. No longer handles money. No longer goes out unaccompanied. Humiliating, but her analytical mind became instantly skeptical of the actual relevance of this list to her individual outcome. How much of this list was due to the progression of Alzheimer's disease, and how much was confounded by the overwhelmingly elderly population it described? Were the 80-year-olds incontinent because they had Alzheimer's, or because they had 80-year-old bladders? Perhaps these 3s wouldn't apply to someone like her, someone so young and physically fit. The worst of it came under the heading communications. Speech is almost unintelligible. Does not understand what people are saying. Has given up reading. Never writes. No more language. Other than misdiagnosis, she couldn't formulate a hypothesis that would render her immune to this list of 3s. It could all apply to someone like her. Someone with Alzheimer's. She looked at the rows of books and periodicals on her bookcase, the stack of final exams to be corrected on her desk, the emails in her inbox, the red flashing voicemail light on her phone. She thought about the books she'd always wanted to read, the ones adorning the top shelf in her bedroom, the ones she figured she'd have time for later. Moby Dick. She had experiments to perform, papers to write, and lectures to give and attend. Everything she did and loved, everything she was, required language. The last pages of the questionnaire asked the informant to rate the severity of the following symptoms experienced by the patient in the past month: delusions, hallucinations, agitation, depression, anxiety, euphoria, apathy, disinhibition, irritability, repetitive motor disturbances, sleep disruptions, changes in eating. She felt tempted to fill in the answers herself, to demonstrate that she was actually perfectly fine and that Dr. Davis must be wrong. Then she remembered his words. "You may not be the most reliable source of what's been going on." Maybe, but then she still remembered that he'd said that. She wondered when the time would come that she wouldn't. Her knowledge of Alzheimer's disease admittedly swept the surface only lightly. She knew that the brains of Alzheimer's patients had reduced levels of acetylcholine, a neurotransmitter important in learning and memory. She also knew that the hippocampus, a seahorse-shaped structure in the brain critical for the formation of new memories, became mired in plaques and tangles, although she didn't really understand what plaques and tangles were exactly. She knew that anomia, a pathological tip of the tongue, was another hallmark symptom. And she knew that someday she'd look at her husband, her children, her colleagues, faces she'd known and loved forever, and she wouldn't recognize them. And she knew there was more. There were layers of disturbing filth to uncover. She typed the words Alzheimer's disease into Google. Her middle finger was poised over the return key when 2 jolting knocks caused her to abort the mission with the speed of an involuntary reflex and hide the evidence. Without further warning or waiting for an answer, the door opened. She feared her face read stunned, anxious, devious. "Are you ready?" asked John. No, she wasn't. If she confessed to John what Dr. Davis had told her, if she gave him the activities of daily living